Hey everyone, in case you didn't know, we launched a YouTube channel for Shopify Masters. So go ahead and subscribe for brand new video episodes. Thank you so much.
We bought every single snack stick on the market and we researched where each of them were being made and we just made phone calls and tried to find a co-manufacturer partner.
Hey, how's it going? I'm your host, Adam Levinter, back with a new episode of Shopify Masters, your companion for starting and building a business. The moment you quit your 9-to-5 to grow your dream business full-time is something you'll never forget. But how do you manage to balance full-time responsibilities while scaling a new brand? And how big is big enough to quit that day job? They're not easy answers, and that's why my guests today are Peter Maldonado and Rashid Ali, the co-founders of Chomps. In 2012, they turned their passion for clean eating into a thriving business, offering grass-fed meat sticks made from sustainably sourced beef, venison, and turkey. But it wasn't until 6 years later that they both went all in. Peter and Rashid developed an analytics and feedback strategy that allowed them to earn $20 million in revenue that first year they quit their jobs. Fast forward to today, and they've scaled to 10 flavors and can be found in stores across the U.S., including Trader Joe's and Costco. I don't know when you registered the We Are the Champions LLC, but that's a pretty cool one. Whose idea was that? Was that yours, Pete?
Probably. I'm sure. We had a pretty small office at the time. It was probably just me, Rashid, and one other person. So, yeah, pretty sure I was... I was all gung-ho about the champion thing. I thought it was kind of clever.
I actually was quite hesitant because the amount of work required to change your LLC, which we didn't necessarily think about once we click, but
right.
I do remember it was Pete's idea. And I was like, Pete, why do we do that? It's creating a lot of work.
So that was when? That was back in 2012, was it?
18 would have been when we changed it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because we started out as Logic Meat Locker was the name of it.
Nice. Now, Chomps, a little bit more brand friendly, let's call it.
A little more. Well, I would say Logic was actually, there was some logic in the name. So like low GI, low glycemic index. It was like, it made sense back then to me, at least. I don't know. Maybe not to anybody else, but.
Okay. So rewinding back, you both had established careers, busy lives. Peter, you're working in the fitness and personal training space. Rashid, I believe you were in consulting. Before you guys started Chomps, how did you first meet?
Yeah, so we met through a mutual buddy in Chicago. This was actually, I think the first time we met was a poker night. So our buddy would host poker nights at his house. And I think that night, my wife and Rashid were the two finalists. And there was some threats being thrown around and my wife gets mad at me when we tell this story, so I gotta, but anyway, she actually threatened to throw Rashid down the stairs if he won, so, and I think he won and he didn't, and she did not throw him down the stairs, though, so she was all bark, no bite.
Is that your recollection, Rashid?
I do remember winning, and she definitely did say that, but it was interesting because the night was about poker, but at some point, Pete and I remember we just started chatting, and he was telling me about this project that he was working on, that he met some guy at a wedding that was an organic meat processor, and he launched a company to compete with Omaha Steaks. And I'm like, who is this guy? Like, I mean, he met some guy, and then from the idea, he started this company. And I was like, I kind of talked to him about my background, and it was interesting because all the stuff that I was strong at when it comes to ops, finance, like, thinking of just how do you run a business, and then versus Pete's really good on the ideation, creative, marketing, sales side of the business. I kind of planted the seed to say, like, would you ever want any help with this endeavor? And the next day we followed up, we ended up grabbing lunch, inked up a partnership agreement, and we were off to the races. So it kind of planted based on that one poker night, but it was just Pete and I off on the sides chatting about what he was working on.
So you draw up a partnership agreement right after that first lunch?
Well, my wife, who's a recovering attorney, she downloaded a template. And yeah, she just drafted some partnership agreement and we moved pretty quickly. Yeah.
Okay. So what's the origin story here from a business and value proposition standpoint? Like, what's the problem you identified that needed solving in the market? And I can turn it over to you, Pete, for that.
Yeah, for sure. So, well, the business initially started at, again, like Rashid mentioned, it was almost like an Omaha Steaks, but it was focused on grass-fed beef. So we're doing steaks and ground beef. And the reason why we started there was because I started CrossFitting. And so I started CrossFitting about 2011. I think one of the things I realized about that whole community there was the people were so diehard about anything that was made for CrossFitters, right? And so like I went out to the CrossFit Games out in Carson, which is like right outside of LA. And there's just thousands and thousands of people there at, and you know, and one of the big things, like a trend I think in CrossFit was like nobody wears their shirts. Like the guys don't wear shirts, right? So you're like, they're walking around and I've never seen more six packs in my entire life. And so I you know, for me in the fitness world, I know what it takes to get and look like that. And these people just walk around like that all day long. So you kind of know how diehard they are about the sport and the nutrition. And so the other thing is like they had a vendor village. It was like a almost like a trade show that was taking a place out right outside the CrossFit Games. So you walk out there and there's all these different, you know, supplements companies or whatever they're selling, like different gadgets or equipment. And then one thing I was noticing though is that there was huge lines for specific products. So one of the brands was called Progenix. And this was a supplements company. And so they were selling like whey protein, like creatine, like just like the normal supplements you could go and get at a GNC. But because this was made by CrossFitters for CrossFitters, they were charging like four times the price of what I could get the exact same stuff for at GNC. And, but people couldn't, they had to have it. They just had to have it because that was the brand. And so for me, it was kind of eye-opening and I realized, you know, this kind of a cult-like following, because of that, if you could create something that starts to sell well, it could take off like wildfire. So that was really the initial reason why we focused on CrossFit. You know, and I feel like it served us well over time, especially when we had no money starting. So it was easier for us to kind of go with very little money, just to go door to door, hitting all these different CrossFit boxes. That's the lingo for a CrossFit gym. Meeting the founders of the gyms and then going in and letting people try the samples. And like, that was kind of the easiest way for us to get some early traction.
And it was interesting. You could call it strategic or call it luck, but aligning on a CrossFit focus, first CrossFitters were very vocal and passionate about what they do. And so when they found products that they like, they would talk about it. So think about influencer strategy before it really was a strategy. Like these CrossFitters were influencers because they walked the walk and talked the talk. They were pinnacles of health, the way they looked as a result. So when they spoke about certain things, their friends who may not even be in CrossFit would follow them. The other thing was the CrossFit community really branched into then paleo, keto, Whole30, other communities we could kind of focus on and allow us to have really targeted efforts. But it all was rooted kind of in that CrossFit community, and then it allowed us to expand out even further.
So when you say, you know, paleo versus keto versus Whole30, et cetera, how were these diets and or these trends shaping the strategy of the company at the time?
It shaped it in a big way because, again, like what I said earlier, just like kind of focusing on that very niche community, it allowed us to kind of make waves and to be known within that small community for a very small dollar amount. Just for us to go so wide and cast a really wide net would have required a lot more funding. But because of that, as Rashid said, we were able to kind of go to these early influencers. And again, to Rashid's point, these were not called influencers back then. They were like the bloggers or whatever that they were, but they had a lot of influence. And so they were putting out great content. And if we could align with those people, that would be a great way for us to build brand recognition. But then on top of the recognition, it was also kind of that credibility that those bloggers and those people putting out that content already had. So we were kind of leverage their relationship with their audience. And that was the big thing. I think, you know, one of the things we realized is like building and the business block by block and us maintaining and building a genuine direct relationship with the audience, which wasn't entirely scalable, right? Because like nowadays it'd be really tough to do that with millions of customers. But back then when it was 10, 20, a couple hundred customers, it was easy for us to go and, you know, have direct conversations. And I think early on it was, you know, I just basically managed all the inbox. So if you wrote into, you know, our email there, if you had any kind of issues or whatever, I was the one responding. And I think early on that allowed us to really build these, you know, authentic and direct relationships.
When you say you're going door to door selling these product samples to CrossFit boxes, like, did you have a website spun up at the time? Did you have a brand? Like, did you just have sort of a small inventory of product samples that you were trying to sell at the time? Like, what did the first inning of this thing look like?
Yeah. So let's back up a bit, because I got to give the kind of like the timeline of how this all happened. So when we launched the business, I learned how to create a website using a template on WordPress initially. And this was like right before, I think Shopify was getting big and I really hadn't heard of it yet. But then I heard that Shopify might be an easier one, especially for e-commerce. So I was having this real issue trying to get this WooCommerce plugin for my WordPress website to work, and spent a bunch of time trying to figure this out. I had no background in web development or coding or anything like that. So it was just kind of like just wasting a lot of my time. But then I went and tried Shopify, and I figured I would just try to have a second website and see if that was any better. And oh my God, like within like a couple of days, I bought a template and I had it up and running. I was taking orders. We had our moms actually on there, but they were our first customers. And it was like, oh my God, this is so much easier. It makes a lot more sense. So got rid of WordPress, focused 100% on Shopify. Put a little more time, like over time, like once we had like a working website, we would go hire a photographer, get some more images. We would do like video, whatever it was. Like, so slowly just kind of building into it. But we already had a functioning website where we can convert, we could take orders. During that time, though, we figured out that the concept that we were selling was going to change completely. And it started out almost like, you know, it was frozen beef that we were shipping to customers. We realized very quickly, we were doing this in the middle of the summer, and you would ship it out to the customer. If they weren't home, the package would sit there on their doorstep for a day or two or whenever they picked it up, and the meat's completely rotted. And who would have to pay for that? Us. And so we figured out very quickly that that was not what we wanted to spend our time doing. And we just honestly felt it wasn't scalable. Obviously, ButcherBox has proved us wrong in a big way because they have a great business now. But I think for us, it just really wasn't something that we were focused on doing, especially as a side hustle, because that's, you know, we both had full-time jobs. So we were already selling, though, chomps. They had to be refrigerated. It was 8 sticks in a package. So you got like 8 sticks and they were all an ounce. So it was an 8-ounce package. And we were selling those on the website with all the steak and ground beef, but the people would buy them, and we kept getting feedback from everyone saying, we love these sticks, we love chomps. And we actually already named it chomps, and I had this terrible logo that I kind of created for it, using like, I think, word art on Microsoft Word. And so we had the feedback already. But the thing that we realized was we had to create something shelf stable and single serve. And if we could figure those two things out, I think we have a home run. So we just went to town figuring that.
Yeah, and the co-man that we were using for the steaks really didn't have, right? Because if you're making a ready-to-eat product, it's a different beast versus just a butcher. And so Pete and I learned very quickly that any meat product has to have a USDA establishment number printed on that product. And so effectively, we bought every single snack stick on the market, and we researched where each of them were being made, and we just made phone calls and tried to find a co-manufacturer partner that would A, consider even working with us, B, would be able to do a low MOQ, minimum order quantity, that would make sense, right? Because we didn't necessarily have consumers at the time. And then 3 is to make sure that they would meet the attributes we wanted, right? In addition to the grass-fed and grass-finished, we wanted zero sugar. We wanted to use clear casing. There were certain things where we really wanted to make the product a certain way, and it went against the science that most of these guys were used to. Sugar is used to allow them to hit shelf stability. It's not necessarily a sweetening aid. It actually helps with the manufacturing process. So when you remove it, it's a very tough product to make. And so we stumbled on this small little co-man at the time in Greentop, Missouri. And Kevin Westerns was the, he was running this small operation. He had taken it over from his father, who was like the local butcher in the area. And a lot of these, that's how it starts. They originally just kind of, it's a butcher shop. They do some of the harvesting of hunters, animals that they hunt. And it just kind of evolved where Kevin had this idea around, hey, snack sticks is where it's at. I really want to focus there. And he was excited about what Pete and I were thinking and was willing to partner with us and really start allowing us to do a few hundred pounds or a few thousand pounds of production versus some of the bigger guys. Most of them wouldn't even pick up the phone. And so I get, we were pretty lucky landing on that partner that would work with us to create the formula. You know, the recipe we developed with him is the same original beef recipe we have today.
Mm. It sounds like that was a good partnership to have early on. I mean, you are bootstrapping the business. As I understand it, you started with something like $6,500 in your pocket. I would assume that at some point you grow out of this co-manufacturer in Missouri and you move to another manufacturer. Like, what does that process look like? When did you outgrow that initial partnership?
So it's interesting, like that's normally what happens, right? Where the smaller one that can work with a brand at a certain scale is not able to grow as quickly, especially if you think about the growth trajectory that Chomps had. But in the early days, we were growing at the right clip that allowed Kevin to grow his facility around us. And then when things really changed in 2016, when we onboarded a significant retail partner, he said no to us probably a dozen times because the volume would have just collapsed his operations. But I think we asked the question in enough different ways where eventually we got him to say yes. And that co-man is now still one of our six processing facilities and one of our top facilities that is putting out significant volume. So he ended up growing the facility. He ended up taking some outside money and eventually selling. But that facility is still within our network and it makes phenomenal product, which is rare. I mean, I would say like typically that's not the case.
So if you say that that co-man is one of six facilities, like how do you maintain the quality that you expect for the product and the consistency that you want throughout that manufacturing process when you have to manage six different manufacturing partners?
Yeah, it's a big feat and it's one that it took a lot of work in developing the infrastructure we have today to make sure that the team can execute on that. So one thing is we manage all the protein sourcing, right? It's critical that the beef or the turkey or the venison is sourced from the same place at the same specifications. So we manage that. The seasoning blend has to be procured from the same place, pre-blend. It's pre-blend off-site. So when it's delivered into the facilities, it's the same mix. And then we also have a very robust manufacturing team, quality team, food scientist team, where we're having folks on site monthly to make sure that the co-mans are following our standards. We also now have a sensory team where they're actually testing to make sure that the product is coming out consistent each time. And then another piece that's quite unique is we own all of the packaging assets. So on site at each of the co-mans, while it's a third-party facility, any packaging line is fully Chomps owned and it only is running Chomps product. And the reason we made that investment, because it is quite significant, you think about each of these lines could be anywhere from $500,000 to $750,000. And I think right now we have about 10 lines operational. It's a quite significant investment. But in the early days, we did not have a consistent product. It was all over the place. So we implemented 100% hand inspection. So once the product was made, it was shipped to a third-party warehouse. And at the time, Pete and I, or even our wives and friends, were actually going through and inspecting every stick to make sure that it was consistent color, the seal was proper. We would let the product sit anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks to see if a leaker formed and the stick got moldy, we'd be able to cull it out. And so when we did that, we realized that all these defects were rooted in the packaging line. And a lot of times it was at the beginning of the run. So these packaging lines are meant just to be run and not touched. But when you have multiple customers, these co-mans are changing the dyes out. And those changeovers led to a lot of quality defects. So we made the call to say like, no, we can't have these defects happening. So we have to own the packaging assets. And so we made that call. And it was a result of our kind of pretty robust quality process that was in place.
And Pete, I assume at the same time, you're trying to find product market fit on the consumer side. You're building out the Shopify front end of things. And as I understand, you learned early on that you were talking almost to the wrong people. So as the business is growing, how do you nail down your target buyer demographic?
Yeah. So, well, obviously Shopify provides a lot of, you know, customer data, which is amazing. We had Google Analytics data as well to leverage. And then additionally from there, we would actually just reach out. So again, having that authentic, direct relationship to the customers, especially early on, is super important, especially so because you want to kind of understand who your customer is. Nowadays, though, we're a little more sophisticated than that. We have actual panel data where we leverage third parties. That's where all they do is, you know, help us to go and get widespread answers from these people. So they're able to go and get like different panels and surveys or whatever it might be that they're doing. So, so with that 2018, actually, it was the first time that we were able to actually afford that type of data. And when we paid for a third party to do it, they actually came up with something very different than what we were seeing in our GA data and our, even in the Shopify data. So, and we learned for the first time that our customers were about 70% female, which, you know, early on, you know, Rashid and I created as something that we thought was good for ourselves. Like all the branding, the product, all of that was really made for us, and we thought other people might like it, right? So, and I sent you guys over a picture of what the early packaging looked like. The logo is completely different than what you see now. The packaging had cowhide in the background. And then the actual logo looked like a rusted cow brand almost. So it was much more masculine than we have right now, but also just very, I don't even know what you want to call it. It's kind of hardcore. Like there was nothing soft about it, right? It's very in your face about like, yeah, you're eating an animal right now, which I think is, you know, that does not go over well with a lot of customers. I think back then we had a little bit of leniency because I think we were serving a very niche audience, the paleo community. Those people were kind of diehard. If you think about like, Epic Bar, that's another brand that, you know, that we kind of launched around the same time as. Those guys have like a big picture of like a deer head on their venison product, or like the same thing for like a cow or whatever. And we were realizing like that's just, you know, way too harsh. Like people don't want to actually look at the animal that they're eating. So we were able to soften that a lot. We were able to go, and we did a lot of other things too in terms of just standing out on shelf. We did not want this masculine looking packaging anymore. We needed something more female friendly. And when I say female friendly, that's not feminine. You're not going to have a bunch of like pinks and purples and all of those types of, you know, feminine colors, but we wanted it to be female friendly. And again, all of these decisions were being made based on actual feedback from customers or panel data. And we had a bunch of females on the team then, and they were all like dead set that we cannot have a feminine brand. So we're really happy with where it all turned out. So we've got a flood of color on all the packaging. So we have our typical red for our original. We've got, you know, and if you look at the brand block on shelf now, it pops off because we're up against like the Jack Links and Slim Jims of the world where it's red, it's black, it's very masculine. And then there's Chomps as it stands out.
Some great points. Rashid, Pete said something I wanted to get your take on, which is this idea that the initial version of the product is something that you guys made for yourselves versus doing all of this initial primary, secondary market research to find out, you know, what the market wanted and then developing a product and or a brand around that. So just for founders that might be listening, do you think the way you guys approach this, which is to start with something that you yourselves would buy, is the right approach, at least in the early days, and then let the data tell you what to do with the brand? Or do you feel like you would have done all of this initial research to get the data up front and then build product market fit after that?
Based on how Pete and I are wired, I don't think we would have done a bunch of research before we started running. But while Pete is exactly right, the initial idea was like, hey, I used to eat a bunch of Slim Jims. Can we make a healthier version? It was rooted in serving a community that wanted a product, right? So at the same time, it leaned into the CrossFit. So it wasn't about like, we want to make it because it's gonna be something we consume. That was a benefit. It was really saying, we could also lean into this community that would help grow volumes. And then we tried to find other communities to help grow it. So I think there's a little bit of a difference there where it's like, it wasn't a filling a void. We're like, we don't have any snacks that we can eat or convenient. The idea came from, well, we used to eat this. Could we use that to serve these communities? But it's interesting because the way that we think about the brand and the product evolved as Pete and I matured and our lives changed. Because originally it was these two single guys that had this side hustle and it was kind of fun and exciting. But fast forward to around, 2016, 2018, Pete and I get married. We have families, we have kids. We start looking at labels and we start realizing that like a lot of the food that our kids are eating is garbage. And so then you almost see a shift in the way we think about the company and the culture. And it really translated into a real significant growth and velocities on the shelf when we really leaned in. And it was just like a natural progression on how we thought about the brand and the real passion behind it.
Rashid, when you jump in full time in 2018, was that because the revenue was at a certain point that it just justified you diving in full time? Did it have to do with this retail partnership you inked in 2016? What were the factors that led to making that decision?
Yeah, I think some of it was like, it was personal because my wife wasn't working. We had one kid at the time. And so there was a bit about, could the business afford two incomes? Pete went full-time in 2016 when we got the retail launch, and that retailer was Trader Joe's, and it transformed the business. We were really heads down focused. And then when 2018 came around, there was just so much momentum behind the brand. It required 100% focus of both Pete and I, and we needed to start building a team. So it was time where I had to kind of return my laptop and stop consulting and just go heads down. I think long and hard about like, did I wait too long? And I do believe that the timing worked out well because again, we didn't want to pull cash out of the business unnecessarily. And especially around the 2018 time, that is when we started going a little bit harder on retail, which is a lot more cash. There's a lot of more cash required to go down the retail route. I mean, Shopify, Amazon e-commerce is great because you typically get the cash up front, right? Before you even ship the product. So it allowed us to really fund the business with just that model. Retail is not the case. You have to have inventory in hand, has to be on the shelf. It just takes so much more time for that cash cycle to happen.
Pete, when did you decide to go all in and quit your full-time job?
I would say I was a bit skittish with this venture because I've had some previous failures. I think I came off of one. This is back like during the real estate crash of 2008, 2009. I was also starting a food business at the time. And I had my hands in a lot of different things. And all at the same time, they all came crashing down on me. So I lost it all. I lost my houses. I went into personal bankruptcy. It was pretty much rock bottom. This was my first real venture coming out of all of that. And I think I was I'm a risk taker, and that's how I'm wired. But I went through a lot. And so this was a situation where I was like, okay, I want to be able to grow something. And I want to make sure that before I go all in, I'm in a decent spot. And so I think, we were already feeling like this thing is going to work. We were like, it was proven to us like, every so often there'd be a new thing that comes out or new thing we experience that makes us realize like, man, this thing has legs. And then I think like landing Trader Joe's, like we just realized like, okay, we need to go all in and focus 100% of our time here. So again, it was over 4 years of doing this almost as a side hustle. And I was doing real estate at the time. So I kind of made my own schedule too. Which was really nice. I didn't have a full-time job or a boss or had to go into an office or anything like that. I was kind of just doing things on my own. But I don't regret doing it the way I did it because I think going full-time back then, I think it would have just been biting off a bit more than I could chew.
Yeah. I mean, is that worth it to the business? I understand there's pros and cons, but as you mentioned, Rashid, and you could take this one, Pete, if you want, but what's required from an initial investment standpoint to get on the shelves of like a Trader's or a Costco or a Walmart takes a lot of upfront capital. And the margins on most of these products are pretty slim. Pete, do you feel like it's been worth it to get into retail?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from a brand awareness perspective alone, I mean, that's just been, it would be really tough to continue building the brand and the brand awareness the way that we have without having that omni-channel focus. Although I will say we had such an advantage over any other brand that we compete with in the space because we spent over 4 years building a brand using Shopify, using social media. It's kind of like these grassroots, just doing this thing, you know, brick by brick. And then when we finally landed on shelf, now we were able to actually use our community that we already had. We had a loyal following, loyal customers. And we said, hey, listen, the product's now available here. And then they all go out to the stores and they buy it. And you see that in the velocities. We came out guns blazing. And I think, you know, I don't think there's any coincidence of that. You know, we put the work in early on to build a brand. So we had that brand awareness to get on shelf and to actually create a bit of a pull off shelf. You know, and then from there, you're able to continue kind of building and focusing and trying new forms of media and all of that.
How do you get into that first retailer? Does Trader Joe's come to you and they say, hey, I came across your website. It looks amazing. Let's talk. Or are you guys knocking on the doors? Like, how did that first partnership happen?
Well, first off, our story is definitely not the norm. We are very fortunate for things to have happened the way they happened for us. And to be completely honest, we really had no aspiration to even go into retail. We always thought that this was going to be a side hustle. It was going to be a website. Shopify was going to take our orders for us and we were going to fill them in our, you know, spare time, or we're going to have like a third party order fulfillment partner. And then when Trader Joe's called us, they found the product, actually because of Whole30. So it was one of the certifications that we've had. So one of a family member for a very high up person at Trader Joe's was on a Whole30, brought the product home. She was buying it through our website. And then, I guess her mom called us and said, you know, we'd love to put the product in the store. And then, you know, you have the obvious conversations about, you know, can you support the business and do you have the funding and all of those things? And the obvious answer was yes, of course. So from there, we ended up having to kind of scramble to kind of put the, get our ducks in a row to launch there. But that's how it happened. But I wouldn't say for anybody starting a business, I would not sit around waiting for a retailer to reach out to you, because that's not the norm by any means.
Yeah, I think Trader Joe's is a complete anomaly because they have their own distribution network, right? Within the natural space and conventional grocery, you know, there's two main distributors, Unify and Kehe. And the typical approach is you need an anchor retailer to allow you to turn on a warehouse, and that's where you do more outreach, right? So if you want to get into the Whole Foods or Sprouts or Albertsons Safeway, like typically you need to get a buyer to say like, yeah, I'm willing to take this product. And then those distributors are willing to then place the orders, because you're actually getting the orders through the distributor, not even through the retailer. So it's a little bit different. Trader Joe's, you deal with them direct. And so they're an amazing initial partner, but it also doesn't tell you how the games actually work. Because once you add a distributor into the mix, it makes it a lot harder.
Do you feel like there has to be some strategy related to which retailers you choose to go into from a brand standpoint? For example, I can see how this brand would fit within a Trader Joe's. I'm not convinced that this would be fruitful from a brand equity perspective in a Walmart, let's say, for example. Do you think about it that way at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you want to think about is if the consumer doesn't already get what you're trying to do, you need to overinvest with marketing and trade to convince that consumer to purchase, right? So you want to be on shelves that are bringing the type of consumer that gets your value proposition. It's interesting you make the comment about Walmart, because Walmart is a fantastic partner of ours, a significant part of our business, and we're continuing to grow and partner with them. And in 2018, like Pete and I were chatting as we start talking about different retailers, and I didn't think the Chomps consumer is the Walmart consumer, but I was completely wrong, right? I mean, I think as we continue to grow the brand and grow our consumer base, like it resonates with a very broad type of consumer. And it takes time though. I think if we launched in 2016 with Walmart, I don't know if we would have been successful, because a Walmart footprint is the store is such a bigger footprint. It's tougher to get those consumers. You know, by the time we finally launched there, we had the brand awareness and it was starting to turn and perform. But you're exactly right. Not all shelves are created equal, right? You have to be really strategic around when is the right time to launch into a certain channel. Another great one would be like C-store. We still really haven't gone all in on the convenience channel. We're just now starting to get our groundwork, and we have a key partners that we've launched in, but it's been a slow process because, again, it's a hard channel to win at because of the way it's set up.
I should also say, I'll walk back my question a little bit in the sense that I know that Walmart has become a much bigger player in organics over the last 5 or so years and is right up there. On the D2C e-commerce side, Pete, so many changes to e-commerce in general on a macro level, starting with sort of pre-pandemic e-commerce into pandemic e-commerce and now post-pandemic e-commerce, lots of changes related to iOS updates and other marketing, increasing CPC and CPM rates. What have you changed strategically on the D2C e-commerce side in terms of marketing and customer acquisition?
I think nowadays we're relying a lot on content strategy. And I think, leveraging really good content is key. And I think that is going to be one of the things that it levels the playing field, but it's also where the people that are really good at it are going to, they have a strong advantage. I think that's also somewhere where a small challenger brand like ours, we stand a chance competing with the big behemoths out there, the billion-dollar brands. Because if we're able to go put out really good creative and content that people actually want to consume, that could allow us to build a brand much bigger than we ever could, without leveraging that. So in my point of view, content strategies is key. And then obviously, having strong creatives, we test, and we're always trying to test and learn and figure out what's working and what's not. A lot of times it's things that we think would work, and it just doesn't work, or it doesn't work the first time. And then we'll make, very minor tweaks and put it back out and, try it, and we'll figure out that's working. So we're just getting better at what we're doing. And when I say testing different media options, testing different, if we're putting a paid ad out and one doesn't work, it's not converting, we'll make very small tweaks and then put it back out and we'll find that works. And so we're kind of just learning over time how to get better and better at it. One of the things we did this year that completely shifted, it was about a year ago now, actually, is where we're now focusing on brand awareness. So very high top of funnel, where everything before this was all bottom of funnel. We were all about conversions, because we're a bootstrap business. It was all about quick ROI. Nowadays, we're making major investments into forward-looking growth and just making sure that we're, again, building brand awareness. And Rashid kind of touched on this, but the way we think about this is brand awareness needs to stay light years ahead of distribution. So if our distribution, if we're anticipating landing X number of thousands of stores in the next number of years, we need to have those households need to understand who Chomps is. And they should not be the first time they're seeing it is on the shelf. They should be seeing it somewhere else as, another initial touch point, and they should know something about the brand before we show up on shelf. By the way, that was a real tough pill for us to swallow, because as a brand, we're like following every little dollar we spend, and we need to make sure we have this type of ROI on it. And this was actually our partner, Stride Consumer Partners. It's a private equity partner we brought on in 2021. They're amazing at this, and they've built a number of brands much bigger than Chomps is, and so we've learned a lot from them. Definitely outside the comfort zone, but we're seeing the value.
Yeah, I do want to ask you about Stride in a moment, but just sticking with this idea of driving ROI versus brand awareness. So two questions. First off, which platform from an ROI perspective is most profitable for you on the acquisition side? And the second part of this question, which perhaps is a separate question in and of itself, how do you measure brand awareness?
I would say from a profitability standpoint, I think most of our e-commerce channels are about the same, but it's also because we manage the amount of advertising spend that we will allocate to a certain channel. One of the big unlocks that I can add that onto what Pete was saying earlier is that we realized that for the longest time, we always wanted to try to drive people to Shopify because we really captured the most consumer data. But we've realized as we think more omni-channel, the consumer is going to buy where the consumer buys. And if you want to change behavior, you're going to have to invest to do that. So now, you know, if the consumer is going to buy on Thrive Market, let them buy on Thrive Market. Like, we don't have to overinvest in paid ads to try to drive them back to Shopify. If they're going to buy on Amazon, let them buy on Amazon. If they're going to come to our website, Shopify, let them come to chomps.com. Those are the brand loyalists, right? We will be able to get them on subscription. They'll be able to try all our flavors. But we realized, and it was really tough because we were so gung-ho about like driving that traffic to chomps.com. Changing the approach on how we think about traffic and the consumer, it was pretty eye-opening in our ability to be more effective with our dollars. So I would say that each of the channels, like some are, you know, a little bit more expensive, but the team is very disciplined as far as how we'll invest on marketing to be able to drive that. I mean, we're profitable across all channels. There's not one where we're losing money, which again, a lot of brands will say they have a healthy D2C business, but they're losing money. Chomps, the form factor is amazing for shipping, right? If you think about how dense it is, it's the perfect online product. And we kind of lucked out on that. And we understood our unit economics to make sure that we can build profitable businesses on each of those channels.
Because it's lightweight, it's ship friendly, all these things.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead, Pete. From a brand awareness standpoint, when you say you weren't thinking about that early on, but as you've grown, this becomes more of a priority, is there any way to measure and track brand awareness?
Yeah, there is. I mean, we have social listening tools that we're using. We have, you know, various like sentiment tools, like how are people thinking about the brand? We have other data that we use. One of them is household penetration. So we want to understand, like, you know, people that are buying the product. But those are actually existing customers, though. But we're realizing, you know, these new channels that we're getting into have. Some channels have a much greater impact on household penetration than others. And so we're learning a lot about all of that. We're seeing our household penetration is exploding right now, which is nice because to your point earlier, it's about like which channel, which retailer is going to work for you, right? Nowadays, we're realizing that we have such brand awareness that we could probably be successful in any channel. And so we're kind of proving that out. And especially C-Store was one that we were really worried about. And we're finding now in the initial customers where we're in, we're seeing very strong velocities. So this is somewhere we're gonna lean in. But yeah, we're constantly trying to get better and better about figuring out, you know, the strength of the brand, how do we stack up? And we also want to follow the competition to kind of see how are people thinking about them? And that gives us a good idea of where we sit.
Great. Pete, you did mention Stride. This is your private equity partner. You guys raised $80 million from them circa 2021. What did you learn or have you learned regarding fundraising or the fundraising process? And looking back, is there anything that you think you would have done differently?
Yeah. So I would say the one thing that Rashid and I learned, and the good things that we kind of had an idea going into the process of what we were looking for, we weren't, the cash part of it, and getting a check was important, but that was more of kind of table stakes to be in the process, right? So we had, it wasn't the amount of money that we were looking for. We were looking for an expertise. We wanted advisors to come in, people that have been there and done it. And the way Rashid and I say this all the time, we want to learn from someone else's scar tissue, right? And so we had no real background in CPG before this. And for us, like, we were learning on the job, but we're realizing as the business gets bigger and bigger, the opportunities are greater, but so are the risks. We have something real to lose, right? So one of the, you know, we just wanted to go and find somebody that had been through all of the ups and downs that we were currently facing and just be able to kind of lock arms with them and build the business. So Stride has been amazing. And one of the things that we loved about them, when you're in this process of raising money, you're going to have these investors and they're all going to pitch to you about their successes. They're all talking about, I had this win, that win, this one. What I loved about Stride, we both love this too. They came out and they were talking about the challenges they faced with other investments. They've had investments that failed. They've had investments that went through ups and downs. They had to roll their sleeves up and get in the weeds to kind of break through it. And so that's who we wanted as a partner. because when you're running a business, it's not going to be, you know, all up and to the right. It's not all going to be, you know, rainbows and butterflies. If anybody tells you that, they're lying. So we wanted someone that was going to be able to, you know, was going to be a good partner, not when it's just amazing. And we want to make sure that they're going to be there when things get tough. And that's who they've been. So I would say in terms of that partnership, I have, you know, I think neither of us have a regret there.
Yeah, no, I think to Pete's point, they've been a fantastic partner. The other value they bring is, like, we always thought we were good from a data and strategic perspective, but they just bring a different lens and come at it a different way. Pete and I already are very different. The way I look at the world is different than that of Pete, but they bring this different angle. And they also, I mean, when they were looking at, when we were going through the diligence process and they were looking at Chomp's performance and kind of the art of possible, like, they were almost more excited about the brand than we were because they saw what growth potential could happen. And it's like, Pete and I had never sat in this seat before and really understood what the art of possible was. And they really helped us kind of understand that, like, you guys have something really special here. The data is telling a story that we haven't seen before. And so having someone on the bench that was more excited about the brand than we were was amazing. And it continues to be the case. Like, they are our biggest cheerleader. They're in the trenches with us. And they challenge us in all the right ways, right? Pete and I kind of, we have a good idea of what we do well. And so what we need is someone that can help us say, like, where are their blind spots? Where there's opportunities we can do better? And they continue to challenge us in all the right ways.
It was great having you both here, Peter and Rashid. That's Peter Maldonado and Rashid Ali, the co-founders of Chomps. Our show is produced by Gogo Zoger and Megan Coyle. Our engineers are Matt Schwartz and Miku Betlem. Benjamin Gottlieb is our managing producer. And I'm your host, Adam Levinter. Come hang out with us every Tuesday and Thursday to catch a brand new episode of Shopify Masters. And hey, if you're still here, go share this episode with another entrepreneur. Thanks.